Hey, everybody, and welcome back to The Deep Dive. Are you ready for an adventure?
Always.
I like that attitude. Today, we're trekking to the edge of a vanishing glacier in Swedish Lapland.
Oh, wow. Sounds chilly.
Pack your virtual parka, because we're about to witness a story of resilience and life you won't believe. Just picture this. A vast, icy landscape slowly giving way to bursts of color.
Like wildflowers blooming where there was once just ice?
Exactly. It's a vibrant tapestry of plant life emerging where you'd least expect it.
Okay, you've definitely got my attention. What's the story here?
Well, we'll be diving deep into a 2019 study from the journal Arctic, Antarctic, and Alpine Research. It's by Marcus Franson and his colleagues.
Intriguing. And is there anything that makes this particular deep dive, well, extra deep?
Oh, absolutely. We're not just talking about plants here. We're talking about adaptation, resilience, and the surprising speed at which nature reclaims even the most, well, seemingly barren landscapes.
Okay, I'm hooked.
Great. Because to add another layer to this, we'll also be weaving in some historical parallels from the work of botanist Sten Selander, who explored this region back in the 1940s. So it's like we have this amazing time-lapse view of this ecological change over decades.
Wow, a time-lapse view of nature reclaiming a glacier?
Okay, so let's set the stage here. Where exactly are we headed in Swedish Lapland?
We're talking about the Ommajallejekna Glacier, tucked away in the remote northwest corner of Swedish Lapland.
Remote, huh? Give me a sense of just how remote we're talking.
Well, let's just say there are no roads, no permanent residents. The nearest village is a good 70 kilometers away.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's definitely off the beaten path.
You could say that. And to add to the drama, this glacier has been shrinking at an average rate of 0.17 square kilometers per year.
Okay. That's a pretty significant change. So in a relatively short time, we're talking about a lot of newly exposed land.
You got it. So imagine you're a plant.
Okay. I'm a plant.
Suddenly finding yourself in this newly exposed glacier foreland, what kind of challenges are you up against? Well, I'm guessing the growing season isn't exactly long.
You're thinking on the right track. We're talking short growing seasons, high precipitation, freezing temperatures, and even the occasional surprise snowdrift in the middle of summer, just for fun.
Oh, fantastic. So back in the 1940s, when Selander was exploring this area, what did he find? Was there any sign of life in this, well, pretty intense environment?
Well, he documented Saxifraga rivularis.
Hold on, remind me, what's that again?
It's a small hardy plant. You often find it in harsh Arctic environments. It's pretty amazing it can survive there at all.
Right. To thrive in that environment, it must be very good at dispersing its seeds to reach such a remote location.
You're exactly right. And get this, that's pretty much all he found on the newly exposed land back then.
Just one lone species braving the element.
Exactly. But fast forward to the Franzen study, and things look very, very different.
Okay, I'm sensing a plot twist here.
Big time. Franzen and his team found a whopping 68 plant species in the youngest terrain. That's the land that's been exposed within the past 31 years.
Wait, 68 species? That's a huge jump from just one.
I know, right? It's an explosion of biodiversity in just a few decades. Talk about a makeover.
So what happened? Did things just finally have enough time to, I don't know, get growing? Or is there more to it?
Well, time definitely plays a role, but it's not the whole story. The research points to something called a chronosequence. Think of it as a series of snapshots.
Snapshots.
Yeah, like snapshots taken at different times. It allows researchers to compare plant communities in areas exposed at different times since the glacier retreated.
Ah, so it's like watching ecological succession unfold, but in fast forward.
You got it. And what's really mind-blowing is the speed of this change. The study documented a colonization rate of over 2 new plant species per year.
Hold on. 2 new species every year. That's a lot. So who are these botanical pioneers leading the charge? What makes them so successful at colonizing this challenging new frontier?
Well, think about it. The first hurdle is simply getting there, right? It all boils down to something called propagule pressure. Basically, the more seeds that reach an area, the higher the chances of successful colonization.
So it's a numbers game. The more seeds, the merrier. But those seeds also have to be equipped for the journey, right?
Exactly. And that's where plant traits come into play. The study identified 3 species that are really thriving in this glacier foreland: Po alpina, Salix herbacea, and our old friend, Saxifraga oppositifolia.
What makes these species so well suited to conquer this new terrain?
Well, for starters, they're locally abundant, meaning they've got a strong presence in the surrounding areas, so there's a good source of those all-important seeds. They also tend to have small, lightweight seeds.
You're fit for wind dispersal.
Right on, it's like they're built for travel.
So they're in the right place at the right time with the right gear. And it sounds like there's even more to it. You mentioned plant families earlier.
Yeah. It turns out these successful species belong to families like Saxifragaceae, Salicaceae, and Asteraceae. They're known for their adaptability and effective dispersal strategies.
Fascinating. So I'm guessing that means some plant families are at a disadvantage in this race to colonize the glacier foreland. What about the plants that aren't as successful? What did the study find?
Well, there are two families that stood out, Rosaceae and Orchidaceae.
Interesting. And they're having trouble even though they're present in the surrounding areas.
Right. They're just struggling to establish themselves in this newly exposed environment.
Why is that?
Well, take the Rosaceae. Many species in this family have large, fleshy fruits.
Not ideal for wind dispersal, I'd imagine.
You're right. They often rely on animals to help disperse their seeds.
But I guess in a brand new environment like this, those animal partners might not be around yet.
Exactly. It's a matter of timing and having those ecological relationships in place. Now, Orchidaceae, they have tiny seeds, which are great for wind travel.
What's the problem there?
They depend on specific fungi in the soil to survive. It's this crucial symbiotic partnership they need.
Oh, I see. So until those fungal partners show up and establish themselves, it's like they're arriving at a party without a dance partner.
Perfect analogy. And this really highlights just how delicate the interplay is between dispersal, plant traits, and environmental conditions. It's not just about getting there, it's about having what it takes to thrive once you do.
That makes a lot of sense. So we've got these seeds making this incredible journey to this new land, but the next stage of the adventure is establishing themselves, right?
Right. It's one thing to arrive, but can they actually put down roots and flourish? And that's where things get even more interesting.
It's not exactly a five-star hotel these plant pioneers are checking into.
Right. More like a fixer-upper, really.
Yeah.
We've talked about all the challenges, the short growing seasons, freezing temperatures, all that precipitation. I mean, talk about a rough welcome for a tiny seed drifting in on the wind.
It's true, it's a harsh environment, but here's the thing. Those early colonizers, those tough species that can handle those initial conditions, they actually end up doing everyone a huge favor.
Oh, how so?
They basically pave the way for later arrivals, species that maybe aren't quite as, well, rugged.
Ah, so it's like they're setting the stage, making the environment a bit more hospitable.
Exactly. As these pioneers grow, they enrich the soil, they add organic matter, improve the soil structure. You know, make it better at holding on to moisture and nutrients.
So it's like they're terraforming the environment, making it suitable for other species that, well, maybe need things a bit easier.
That's a great way to put it. And actually, Franzen and his team, they discovered something really surprising about those early colonizers.
Really? What's that?
Their research suggests that plants that prefer drier conditions, those actually did better at first.
Wait, hold on. Drier conditions in this environment? I would have thought with all that precipitation that things would be, well, kind of soggy.
Yeah, you'd think. But this newly exposed terrain, it's not just wet, it's also really, really harsh.
Yeah.
Rocky, thin soil, poor drainage. It's almost desert-like in some ways.
So all that moisture, it could actually be a bad thing, at least in those early stages.
Yeah, it can create conditions that are just too waterlogged, too unstable for most plants to really take root.
Fascinating. So, which plants actually thrive in those initial, almost desert-like conditions?
The study found that chambiphytes were particularly successful.
Chambiphytes, just a quick reminder for our listeners, what are those again?
Think low-growing, hardy plants, like dwarf shrubs. They grow really close to the ground. And that actually offers some protection from the harsh winds and the big temperature swings you get in these environments.
So they're built for those tough conditions. It makes sense that they'd be the first ones to really take hold.
Right. And as things change, as the soil improves, then you start to see more diversity.
And that's where that chronosequence approach really shines, right?
Absolutely. Comparing those different age sections of the foreland, it gives researchers a way to really start picking apart what's driving those shifts in plant communities.
Right. You mentioned earlier that there's a bit of debate about figuring out the abiotic versus biotic factors. Can you break that down for our listeners a little?
Sure. It's a complex system, right? We're talking climate, soil conditions, competition between different species. it's hard to completely isolate the role of each factor.
It's like a big puzzle.
It really is. But even with all that complexity, the Franzen study, it points to this really interesting link between the warming climate and, well, how quickly plants are colonizing the area.
Right. And this is where things start connecting to the bigger picture. We know the glacier has been retreating for over a century, but the Franzen study suggests that the rate of plant colonization, well, it hasn't always been this fast.
Exactly. When they looked at historical temperature data and compared it to the colonization patterns, they found a huge difference between the periods from 1898 to 1946 and the decades since then.
Okay, walk us through that. What did they learn about the link between warming and colonization?
Between 1898 and 1946, so this is when Seelander was out there doing his work, the temperature, it only increased by a tiny fraction of a degree each year, something like 0.00012 degrees Celsius annually.
So very gradual warming, and if I remember correctly, not a lot of plant diversity during that period either, right?
Right. Colonization was incredibly slow, almost stagnant, you could say. But then, since 1946, the temperature anomalies, those have been much more pronounced. We're talking increases of as much as 1.112 degrees Celsius per decade.
Wow. Okay. That's a huge shift.
It is. And what's really striking is that this period of much faster warming, it matches up perfectly with the rapid increase in plant colonization that Franzen's team observed.
So it's like those rising temperatures are creating this opportunity for plant life, like an invitation to diversify.
Exactly. And this is happening even in the most remote corners of the planet, right? Mm. Climate change is altering landscapes. It's driving these ecological shifts on this massive scale.
Okay, so just to recap here. We have this vanishing glacier. It reveals this harsh new landscape, those tough pioneer species like our low-growing chamaelophytes. They take root and slowly make the environment a bit more livable. Then as the climate warms up, boom, we see this huge increase in new plant species settling in.
Hmm.
Did we miss anything?
I think you've summarized it perfectly. And this seemingly isolated story, way up there in the Arctic, it actually has some global implications.
And that's what makes this so fascinating. What seems like a local phenomenon, it's actually connected to these much larger issues.
It really makes you think about the resilience of nature, you know, especially in these Arctic ecosystems.
Yeah.
We always think of them as so fragile, so vulnerable.
Right. It's like we're always seeing that image of the lone polar bear clinging to a shrinking ice floe. But this research paints a different picture, doesn't it?
It really does. It suggests that these ecosystems might actually be able to adapt, even thrive, in the face of rising temperatures, at least in some cases.
So maybe it's not all doom and gloom.
Exactly. Nature is complicated, you know. And the way it responds to a changing climate, well, it's not always what we expect. This study really highlights that.
And it also emphasizes how interconnected everything is. What happens up in the Arctic, it doesn't just stay in the Arctic, right?
Absolutely. Changes in plant communities, those can have this ripple effect. They can influence animal populations, they can change carbon cycles, even impact global weather patterns.
Wow, it really drives home the fact that we're all part of this intricate web, you know? What happens in one corner of the web, we all feel it.
Exactly. And as we face a changing climate, well, understanding those connections is more important than ever.
This deep dive has definitely given me a lot to think about. It's amazing to see nature's resilience in action, but it's also pretty humbling, you know, when you consider the scale and complexity of the challenges we face.
Yeah, it really is.
So if you had to choose just one big takeaway, one thing you really hope our listeners walk away with today, what would it be?
I think it'd be this. The story of the Almataliekna Glacier Foreland. It shows us that change is constant. But so is life's ability to adapt, to find a way to thrive in new and sometimes, well, unexpected ways.
I love that. And for those listeners who want to dive even deeper, we'll include a link to the full study in our show notes.
It's definitely worth a read.
Well, that wraps up another deep dive. Thanks for joining us on this journey to the edge of a vanishing glacier. It was a pleasure exploring this with you.
Likewise.
And listeners, don't forget to subscribe to The Deep Dive and share this episode with anyone who, you know, loves learning something new about our incredible world. Until next time, keep exploring.